But this isn't fiction. This is our lives. This is Martha's life. I'm going to be sick. I stand and whirl around on my heel, prepared to storm off to, I don't know exactly where, when I am confronted with a holy t-shirt-clad broad chest. Slowly, my gaze lifts like I'm a marionette and someone is pulling the string attached to the center of my head. I gasp. Dylan takes off his silver aviators and says,
"The party has arrived."
I would like to say that the first words I said to Dylan were something to the effect of how thrilled I was to meet him or how much his work has meant to me. But instead, it was more of a word salad. "Much tall you are." I've been sitting by the craft services table for an hour and a half now, contemplating each and every single one of those words. It's been a constant stream of crew members grazing past, as they each tell me we should be back to filming any minute now. It'd be a lie if I didn't admit that I was just slightly disappointed to find that after his initial hello, Dylan has been squirreled away in a super fancy trailer with a security guard stationed outside the door. Some silly part of me thought that maybe I'd get to hang out with Dylan during downtime, and we'd develop a rapport. Maybe we'd have inside jokes. I shake my head and roll my eyes at my own naivete. "Hey," says Martha, as she plops down next to me. "You found the food. Good place to set up camp." I wrinkle my nose. I'll be the first to admit that I'm pro-food, like, all the way. But my nerves have got me way too anxious to even gnaw on celery sticks. "Oh my God," she says, leaning in toward me, her hand resting on my thigh for a moment. "Me too." I smile at her gratefully. I'm so glad she's not the version of my competition that existed in my head. I didn't know what I expected from my competitor. Cattiness? Bitingly rude? But Martha is just good. And I think that maybe she deserves this more than I do. "I'm sorry about your sister," I tell her. She half smiles. "Me too." After a moment, she adds, "She would die all over again if she knew I was here doing this." I cough, not sure what exactly to say. "That was a bad joke, huh?" asks Martha. I let out a short laugh. "Well, it wasn't exactly a good one." She shrugs. "Me and Marissa always had a vicious sense of humor. I think she'd approve." Something inside me unlocks. Something I didn't even know was locked away to begin with. I have this wonderful and scary and heart-stopping feeling that I could tell Martha my most hideous thoughts and my most ridiculous hopes, and she'd just sit here, like she is right now, unfazed. And that's sort of a wonderful thing if you think about it. "All right, ladies," says Jill, as she power walks toward us. "We've got you all set up for the challenge portion of the show. So let's head over there and Daria will freshen you up." "Cool," says Martha. "What's the challenge?" Dread settles in the pit of my stomach. This is the part I've been most anxious about. There's always one challenge. Sometimes it's a race or an obstacle course or trivia or some type of competition. But whatever it is, it always ends poorly, with at least one of the contestants being humiliated. "No can do," says Jill. We like for the on-camera reaction to be as authentic as possible. She walks off and then turns, beckoning for us to follow her. "Yeah," Martha says under her breath, "because the first thing I think of when I think of a date come true is authentic." I hiss out a knowing sigh that surprises me, and then it doesn't. I don't even know if I should be here anymore. I've barely even seen Dylan anyway. I take a deep breath, trying my best to shake off the negativity. A few minutes later, we find ourselves standing in a studio with white curtains concealing the walls around us. And Dylan is there, too. Daria flutters around touching up our makeup before dedicating her attention to Dylan. "Nate," says Jill, bringing over a man in a perfectly tailored tux. This is Martha and June, our competitors for this episode. Nate doesn't really need introductions, though. He's the host and face of A Date Come True. There's something comforting about the way his makeup settles into the creases around his eyes. Not everything is as it appears on TV, that's for sure. Nate's smile dazzles as he winks at the two of us, reminding us that he's a pro charmer.
You nervous? He asks. Don't be nervous.
He holds up his hands for us to see.
You're in very good hands, I swear.
After he walks off, Martha and I turn to each other and in unison say, Gross. We break out in a fit of giggles, but we're cut short by Jill.
Let's do this thing. We only want to do one take here, so bring your A-game, people.
Nate takes his position between Dylan and Martha and me as Jill counts down to action.
Okay, we're back, he says.
I feel my whole body straighten as I realize I'm on camera again. Nate turns to Dylan, his voice as smooth as a radio host's.
Now, Dylan, you've thought long and hard about our challenge this week, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Totally, says Dylan.
I guess you could say I cooked up something really cool.
Let's drop the curtain, shall we?
Asks Nate. All around us, the tall white curtains whoosh to the ground, and Martha and I find ourselves in a state-of-the-art double kitchen with brand new stainless steel appliances. Over one side hangs a sign that reads Team June, and the other side has a sign bearing Team Martha. My anxiety washes away for a moment as I realize that, oh my God, this is a cooking challenge! I can cook! I can really freaking cook! I've got this shit in the bag! Then I look to Martha, her eyes huge and full of terror. My stomach twists into a knot as I'm reminded that my success is her failure. It's not that I feel bad for her or think she should win by default on account of her sister. There's just this nagging feeling inside of me that wishes we'd met in real life. But this isn't real life.
Martha, says Dylan. June.
My name. He said my name. Some animalistic instinct in my brain switches on, and I turn into a monster fangirl with blurred vision for anything that isn't Dylan. And hey, don't forget about the freaking cameras, I remind myself.
I'm a total foodie these days, continues Dylan. But back when I was just a little kid, my favorite meal was dinosaur-shaped nuggets with ketchup. So I've decided to ask you ladies to blend my foodie love with my old-school fave and make me some panko-crusted dino nuggets with ketchup made from scratch. You've each been given the same ingredients, and there may or may not be a few red herrings in there.
Nate laughs.
A woman's place is in the kitchen, am I right?
Dylan snickers quietly. I nearly gag. Martha and I exchange a look. More like misogyny, am I right?
Right, says Nate. So you'll each have 5 minutes of Wi-Fi time sponsored by Tune's headphones, and then you'll each have 1 hour to recreate Dylan's childhood dish. And your 5 minutes starts now.
Cut! Shouts Jill.
I should force you to do a retake for that sexist bullshit you pulled, Nate, but we'll just cut it in post.
Nate shrugs and walks off to his dressing room.
You can't get rid of me, Jellybean.
I realize that I have a quick moment to say something to Dylan besides how tall he is. I take a step toward him. Hi, I say. Your, music means so much to me. When I say it out loud like that, it sounds so much more generic than how it actually feels. He turns to me, sliding his sunglasses on.
I would hope so.
He laughs to himself.
I mean, that's why you're here, right?
I force out a dry chuckle, but I can't ignore the disappointment settling in my chest. Yeah, Totally.
Oh, but thanks,
he adds, just as he's swarmed by people armed with cell phones and itineraries. As he's quickly whisked away, crew members buzz around us like bees, changing the lighting for our contest. My throat goes dry, and my stomach feels suddenly heavy. It's that same feeling I get when I'm driving somewhere and I know, I just know, I've taken a wrong turn or missed my exit, no matter what my GPS says.
Okay, girls, says Jill, as she hands us each an apron and ridiculous chef hat, both emblazoned with the show logo. It's just like they said. You get an hour to cook and 5 minutes on the internet with these bad boys.
She hands over two tablets, provided by sponsors too, I'm sure. We'll start rolling in a bit, and we won't interfere, really, unless there's an emergency. Oh, and, no talking to each other during this, or trading secrets or something. She smiles.
Not that you'd want to, right?
We both nod. After she walks away, Martha looks to me and says,
Fuck.
It comes out like one of my brother's long burps that he does on command. I laugh. It's just a dumb challenge, I tell her. Dylan doesn't really care if you can cook. Or maybe he just doesn't care in general. She shakes her head.
You don't get it. I really, really can't cook. And not to be a total pain in the ass, but I'm a vegetarian too. Just the sight of raw meat makes me want to puke.
The color begins to slowly drain from her face. I take a step closer.
Listen, I whisper, my lips nearly brushing against her hair. I know we're not supposed to be helping each other, but just, like, do what I do.
For a brief moment, she squeezes my hand.
I don't know how much that will help, but thank you. I really appreciate it.
As we're carefully positioned with our tablets and notebooks in our own personal kitchens, facing opposite each other, cameras hover around us. I search for things like baking instructions and tips for breading and ketchup recipes. I'm not sure what Martha is searching for, but she looks downright manic. As our time ends, our tablets are taken away and we're left with our notes, our ingredients, and our intuition. I decide to bake instead of deep fry, mainly because I think it might be easier for Martha to follow along. I start in on the chicken, pounding it into submission. I search my supplies and come up with a few different shapes of dinosaur cookie cutters. I push through the chicken, using my weight. It's not easy, but it works. As I mix my breadcrumbs and beat my eggs, I glance over to Martha, whose once beautiful velvet dress is covered in flour, despite her apron. She mumbles a stream of curse words, and I try to offer an encouraging smile, but she's lost in her frustration. I feel awful for her, but the camera guys seem to be really into her cooking nightmare meltdown. I don't think that cooking is specifically for women, but in my house, my mom was always the one in the kitchen. It was her happy place, and she let me share that with her. But unfortunately, the kitchen was her one and only happy place in our house, so when she split when I was in seventh grade, her kitchen became mine. Nothing about being on camera makes me comfortable, but being in a kitchen can almost make me forget that millions of people will be watching me from the comfort of their homes in a few weeks' time. As our hour fades into minutes, I put the finishing touches on my ketchup, including a sprig of parsley.
Time! Jill shouts.
Martha and I wait in silence for a few minutes, as Dylan is summoned from his trailer. We both look and feel like messes. Nate and Dylan stand between Martha and me in front of a table with our presented entrees. Mine is a pile of dinosaur nuggets, some more misshapen than others, alongside what I hope is not totally disgusting ketchup made from scratch. And Martha's dish is fury personified. On her plate is one uncooked chicken breast covered in ketchup with a giant chopping knife sticking out of it. I sigh. There's no competition. One is edible, and the other is decidedly not. We quickly regroup,
and Daria swings through to lightly powder our faces, but she takes no pains to hide the mess we've made of our hair and clothes.
Well, says Nate as the cameras begin to roll again. I guess we won't be doing a blind taste test this time.
I look to Martha and can practically hear her gulp.
Yeah,
says Dylan as he chuckles nervously.
Looks like some kind of horror movie over there.
Martha shrinks back a little. I guess there's a chance she could still win, but it doesn't look good.
June, let's give your dish a go,
says Nate. I nod and hold my plate for the two of them, and they each swipe a nugget through ketchup before chomping down.
Hey, this is pretty great,
Dylan says, his mouth still full.
My wife's gonna kill me if those breadcrumbs have gluten in them,
says Nate.
But it was worth it.
I roll my eyes.
Cut! Shouts Jill. Let's get the girls all cleaned up and ready for the Rose Gazebo.
Daria waves for us to follow her back to the makeup trailer, and once again Dylan is ushered away by a crowd of assistants and managers. I practically jog to catch up to Martha.
Hey, are you okay? I ask.
She shakes her head but says,
Yeah, I'm fine.
It's just a dumb TV show, I tell her as we come to a stop at the trailer, the door swinging shut behind Daria. Martha turns to face me, and I can see that she's pressing her lips shut in some attempt to hold back tears. She shakes her head again before finally bursting, tears streaming down her flower-coated cheeks.
I just thought that if I came on this show and won some dumb date with this ridiculous singer who I don't even really like, I just thought it would give me some kind of closure.
She uses the tips of her fingers to press under her eyes, like she's trying to push the tears back in. I reach for her sticky hands and hold them tightly in mine.
That's not silly or dumb or whatever, I say. I can't even imagine what it would feel like to lose a sibling. Shit, I don't even like my brother and I'd still be a wreck.
We stand there for a moment, hand in hand. We're just two people who were randomly driven together in the most ludicrous of ways by some reality TV show that I can now say without a doubt is more fake than it is real. But standing here with her, this is real. There's just something about her that makes me feel like we could really be something to each other in real life. For reasons I don't know how to explain, Martha makes every nerve in my body light up like a Christmas tree. It's like when Joey Sheck kissed me after 8th grade graduation, and for the first time ever, I felt like my life was a movie, and I was finally the star. I don't know what's going to happen with this ceremony, but I hope that there was a reason for all of this, I finally say. And maybe it's not something you'll understand anytime soon. She looks up and squeezes my fingers tight before giving me a floppy shrug.
Or maybe I will.
The door swings open and we startle apart, like we've been caught doing something much more than holding hands.
Ladies, I can't do my job without your faces, says Daria.
We look much more glamorous than we feel. In the makeup trailer, we gave ourselves glorified sponge baths in an attempt to rid ourselves of sweat and kitchen smells before Daria performed transformations on each of us. My waves have been refreshed and lay perfectly over my shoulders. Wardrobe has put me in a royal blue chiffon dress that sweeps the floor. And Martha is downright stunning in a lacy burgundy dress with a trumpet skirt. After a few hours of waiting to be beckoned, we're driven on a golf cart to one of the far-off lots behind the studio. The set looks like a small town square with a gazebo, and the whole place is dripping with twinkly lights. I recognize it as the usual backdrop for the rose ceremony. For some reason, it hadn't occurred to me that this was a set, and not some tiny little town center outside of Los Angeles. But it's just as fake as the rest of the show. Still, it's hard not to get swept up in the beauty of it. If you can manage to ignore Jill's shouting and all the grunting camera operators. Nate is in his signature tux, and Dylan wears his same holy jeans, but with the added touch of a slim-cut, flat, black button-down shirt. I think I'm going to win. How can they even pick Martha after the kitchen fiasco? But do I even want to win anymore? It's hard to imagine my date with Dylan doing anything more than ruining the version of him that lives in my head. The version of him whose voice cradled me, letting me know that even in my darkest hour, I was not alone. Already there's this sense of mourning settling inside me that I can't quite explain except to say that maybe the version of Dylan I'd built up in my head never existed at all. It's nearly impossible for me to even recall the edge of my seat excitement I felt this morning at the prospect of this moment. Nate and Dylan wait for us on the steps of the gazebo, where a prop master stands with one yellow rose. Dylan wipes his brow as we take our places.
These lights are killer, huh?
I squint up at them, but they don't seem so bad to me. Not any different from the interview lights, at least. Nate pats his forehead to avoid messing up his makeup.
Yeah, they must be testing out something new.
Dylan cringes a little and calls out,
Lissa, we gonna wrap on this soon? I'm not feeling so hot.
Yeah, babe, someone answers from behind the sea of crew and cameras. One and done. We're out. Dylan nods as Nate lets out a loud burp. I reach for Martha's hand one last time, and her fingers intertwine with mine. Almost over, I whisper. She winks. Maybe it wasn't such a bust after all. Jill counts down, and our hands drift apart as we await our completely unreal reality TV show fate.
Ladies, our time together has come to an end. And in just a moment, one of you will move on to a very romantic one-on-one date with Dylan.
Nate gestures to Dylan. Dylan steps forward, the rose in his hand, and says,
I've had so much fun getting to know you both.
Getting to know us? Our paths barely even crossed.
And I want you to know, he continues, that I didn't make this decision lightly. June, I'm so impressed by your dedication to not only me, but to my fans. Mega fans like you are what keep me going. And you slayed the kitchen challenge this afternoon. And Martha, I feel like, whoa, for you and your family. It means so much to me that the last thing your sister heard was my voice. It's so, like, meta.
My skin crawls at the thought of that information feeding his ego. He holds his stomach for a minute before adding,
But after what happened during the kitchen challenge today, it's hard for me to tell if you're...
He burps into his fist.
Excuse me.
And then again.
If your heart is in it. Oh, fuck. I feel like shit. I think I'm gonna...
And then, I swear to God... Everything that happens next occurs in slow motion. Dylan projectile vomits in my and Martha's exact direction. The only thing that saves me is Martha pulling me out of the path of puke.
No, man, don't do that,
says Nate.
You're just gonna make me...
And then Nate is puking, too. Crew members and posse members crowd both Nate and Dylan, and Martha and I are pushed back even farther, reminding us both how very unimportant we actually are.
Those gross-ass chicken nuggets,
Dylan moans.
It's food poisoning. That bitch poisoned me.
I turn to Martha, my eyes wide. Her hand flies up, the back of her palm pressed to my forehead. How are you? Are you feeling all right? I shake my head. I was too nervous to eat all day. She laughs. Me too. I clap a hand over my mouth, stumbling back. Oh my God. I poisoned Dylan. The Dylan. She waves off that notion. Psh, he'll live. They're probably pumping him with fluids and gold as we speak. We both take a minute to glance around. No one is looking for us or checking on us. It's almost a relief. Martha takes my hand. Let's blow this puke show. She pulls me with her to a golf cart with the keys in the ignition. She slides in behind the wheel, and I take my seat next to her as co-captain. I gotta get out of this dress, I tell her. Me too. I feel like a total stranger. As the sun sinks down behind the horizon, she speeds off toward the makeup trailer where we left our street clothes. We both take turns changing inside the trailer, and when we're done, it's like a makeover reveal on a TV show, except this time it's more of an un-makeover, where we just reveal ourselves, our regular, normal, everyday selves. I stand beneath the dusky sky in my leggings and gold flats in my favorite dress, the bright yellow one covered in all kinds of food, from hot dogs and hamburgers to sundaes and donuts. Martha slinks down the steps toward me in the same stompy boots she wore earlier today, and a short, body-hugging violet knit skirt with a black t-shirt that says, "Do no harm, but take no shit." She's the type of person who, if you don't want to kiss her, you probably want to be her. And I think I definitely want one of those things. "There you are," I say, my words coming out breathier than I expected. "Here I am," she says. A speeding golf cart stops to a halt next to us. "I was looking for you two," says Daria, looking paler than I remember. She slumps against the steering wheel and groans. "I'm so sorry," I say. "We just had to get out of there." She shakes her head. "Trust me, things got pretty bad back there." "What do you mean?" asks Martha, taking the final step down. "Well, I guess we all ate whatever Dylan and Nate had, and it was like a puke convention. Not a pretty thing," she says. "Wait," I say. "So it wasn't me? I didn't poison Dylan and Nate?" She shakes her head. "No way, no how. We think it must have been the crab dip from Craft Services." She shakes her fist at the air. "Damn you, delicious crabs." I laugh. Even when she's been puking her guts up, Daria manages to be somebody I want to be friends with. She gets out and stumbles past us up the stairs. "You two had better head home. Jill will call you once she can pull her head out of a toilet, but my guess is we're scrapping the episode." She pauses for a moment, realizing that this might be crushing news for us. "You two were great, though. Really. I meet lots of shitty people on this job, and you both made my job a breeze. Go have fun tonight. For me." Martha turns to me, one brow raised mischievously. "You got plans for tonight?" I bite down on my lip, forcing myself not to blurt something ridiculous like, "I have to run an update on the fan site." "I had a date," I finally say, "but looks like I got stood up." "Still a good night for a date," she says, taking my hand. "I've got a car." I take an instinctive step toward her, like the only thing driving my body is nature. "What do you want to do?" I ask. And then she kisses me, right on the lips. I expected it, but I didn't. It's the perfect mix of want and surprise, which aren't two things I often find in the same place. She pulls back, lingering for a moment, her lips hovering above mine. "Something real," she says.
Say Everything by Huntley Fitzpatrick. Read by Caitlin Davies. To you, he's that boy. The one who breezes through the door of the diner, blowing in fresh air and the pale green smell of still distant spring. Always with the usual crew, the ones from the lacrosse team, full of high spirits and themselves. Your own age, you guess, but somehow younger, carefree, dead sure that the world is theirs to enjoy, with every intention of doing that. They swarm, laughing, jostling shoulders into the biggest booth at the back, four on one side, four on the other. That boy sits on the outside, closest to the aisle. The others grab menus they don't need, since they always order the same old things. Burgers, fries, milkshakes, hot apple pie overloaded with ice cream. All he ever gets is iced tea. Straight up, heavy on the lemon slices. Almost indistinguishable in their lacrosse clothes, those boys could be any team from anywhere. Except that when they wear their blue blazer and khaki uniforms, it's easy to know what school they came from. Private. Preppy. One town over from here. In a different turn of fate, you would have been there too. You might have been as carefree. No worries about money. Certain someone would pick up after you. With a wince, you remember when you were like them. Your major concern that the girls' uniforms were ugly. The boys sweep through their meal. It barely takes 10 minutes. Crowd out, on to the next good time. That boy moves aside to let them go. Flicks a glance toward you, as you hover by the cash register. He catches your eye for a moment, then ducks his head to take a long pull from his straw, the tea reduced to watery ice cubes by now. You walk up to his booth, heart hammering. Why? You do this 10 times an hour during your 6-hour shift. But he's always left with his friends before. Have they given him money this time? Or assumed he'd pay? Rich kid rolls off him like an overdose of Axe body spray. He's been looking down, long lashes fanning his cheekbones, but glances up when you drop the check on the table, lips parting as though he's about to say, "What?" Without a word, he flips his wallet from his jeans, pulls out cash, bill after bill, slides them toward you. "This is the first time I've gotten a $60 tip on a $2 glass of iced tea." Leaning back against the fake red leather of the booth, he gestures to the spaces where his friends had sat. A hasty scan shows you they'd barely covered their tabs, with bonus scatter of extra coins. "You gave me too much," I say. "I'm good at math. You deserve more." "It's your job to compensate?"
"It's my choice to even the score."
His husky voice is even, practical. "No way." You push most of the money back across the table, curl your fingers down, ashamed of your bitten nails.
"Waitress? Hello? I asked for honey mustard on this omelet. This is Dijon."
You look over to see Maeve, your boss, make a guillotine-style chop against her neck. No fraternizing with customers. Then jerk her head toward table 5 with their burning need for a honey mustard on an omelet. Dear God. He's made no move to take the cash, now concentrating on smoothing out the wrapper from his straw, giving that job more attention than it deserves.
"Look, I won't overtip again. I won't tip at all if that bothers you. But whenever I come here, you never sit down. I'd like to see you at a movie or a restaurant. Having fun."
"Are you asking me on a date?"
"Would that be your idea of fun?"
"I don't know. I don't date."
A flick of something. Pity?
Passes like a hand over his face. He sets his elbows on the table, looking at you straight on as you stack up plate after plate.
"It could be a test date. If you don't like it, you never have to do it again. Not with me, anyway. How about tomorrow? I could pick you up at your house, or..."
"Hey, girl, this coffee's stone cold. Do something."
It's the crabby guy at table 9, who always takes up a 4-person table by himself.
"Do something."
"I get off at noon Saturdays. You could meet me here."
"Not at your own home."
"Not now. You used to love having friends over, watching their faces as they saw where you lived, as if that defined who you were." Wherever this boy comes from, you're willing to bet it isn't a second-floor walk-up with bad plumbing.
"Really?"
His voice incredulous, almost cracking, like he can't believe he's gotten your agreement. As if he'd had more arguments lined up like ammunition, ready to fire. Sure. Your answer's braver than you are. His slow smile transforms his face from striking to drop-dead gorgeous, the corners of his eyes scrunching as if you're sharing an in-joke, dimples you hadn't seen before bracketing his lips. You're looking straight at him now, for the first time. Everything you've noticed before came from sideways glances, hair long enough to curl around the backs of his ears, generous lower lip, thinner upper lip that qualifies that generosity. Faint purple shadows under his eyes, suggesting sleep doesn't come easily. Eyes that can't quite make up their mind. Blue with a ring of brown-green around the pupil? Or is that gold? Chameleon eyes. Maybe they tell a truth about him. That he'll be whoever he needs to be, depending on the setting or situation. Something you should remember. You step back, your bussing tray sharp between you like a gray plastic shield. You might want to tell me your name so I don't have to call you Testate. Sean. He raises his hand, as if he's going to shake yours. Old school polite. Then changes course and brushes it through his hair, blue-black in the harsh overhead lighting of the diner. Emma Green. Oh, I know your name. That takes a beat to process. Why? You don't know his. Tomorrow, then? He's reaching over now to gather his friend's remaining plates together, as if cleaning up the table fast will make tomorrow come faster. You map the pulse beating in his throat, the dip and curve of the smooth skin above his collarbone, oddly mesmerized. You look up to find him studying your face for heartbeats that pulsed longer than heartbeats should. Then you look away again. Tomorrow. But, so I know, what will we talk about? I don't know a thing about you. Sean slides out of the booth, flashes that smile. That's what tomorrow's for. He's out the door before you even notice he's left the entire tip on the table.
If you can't be good, be careful, your best friend tells you.
That's your advice, Jen? What are you, a health teacher from the 50s?
I think that covers it pretty well. Text me if he's a psycho or a loser.
So not helpful.
Just quit being the caution queen. Take risks.
Risks haven't turned out well for my family.
For your family, not you. Emma, babe, go be 17.
After 5 years, you'd think you'd be able to separate your roots from your wings. Still hadn't happened. You're afraid it never will. You don't expect a bright purple car, not from a boy whose entire wardrobe seems to consist of his lacrosse jersey or school uniform, or white shirts and baggy khakis. Sean has his back to you, tossing things into the car's back seat. You walk up next to him and clear your throat. He doesn't seem to hear you, so you clear it again, louder, step closer. He straightens, his gaze traveling slowly up your legs to your face, flushes a little. Smile shy now.
You came.
Of course. I said I would. It's not like I was going to skulk out the back door of the diner to avoid you. You sound a little bitchy. Your words shoved between you as if you still had that tray as a shield. He shrugs, offhanded. Then his words come in a rush.
I never take anything for granted.
Turning away, he scoops a pile of catalogs. Victoria's Secret. Sephora. A few copies of Teen Vogue, off the seat and tosses them in the back.
Sorry. This will just take a moment. You'll have to shift the seat back. I forgot how long your legs are.
You're slightly taller than Sean, you notice now. So long legs are... a good thing? Bad thing? God, this was part of the reason you don't date. You need a translator, and you can't afford one.
After you climb in, he pulls open the glove compartment, drops a handful of jewelry into it.
A necklace, a few unmatched earrings, a tube of lip gloss. You crane your neck to see if there's anything even more disturbing in the rear seat. discarded condom wrappers, kicked off high heels, lace thongs. Instead, more catalogs. A flowered scarf, hair scrunchies, a pink hoodie.
How many girls have you had in this car?
What?
Oh, no, nothing like that, Sean says, shifting into reverse. He isn't good at it. Grinding sound.
My sister's car.
A shot of relief. He's never given off that player vibe.
That's why it doesn't exactly throb with testosterone.
Yeah, I found regular gas works better. I had to sell my own car, which did not have a stick shift, obviously. Gary's crazy possessive about this thing. So, learning curve.
You're learning to drive this on a first date?
You almost bite your tongue. First implies there will be at least a second, and possibly many more.
If I'm asking you to leave your comfort zone, not to mention the whole inexplicable I don't date thing, the least I can do is meet you halfway. No worries, though. I watched a bunch of YouTube videos on mastering a standard.
Seriously?
Nope. But Emma, I got this.
He brakes fast at a four-way stop, nearly stalling out. Instead of getting pissed or embarrassed, Sean laughs.
Maybe I haven't got it. Can you drive a stick?
I can.
Go for it.
He pulls over onto the shoulder of the road, settles comfortably into the seat you vacate, folds his arms, completely at ease. No ego on the line at all. You say, after driving for several silent minutes.
How do you know my name, anyway?
Superior espionage skills.
So I'm with a spy?
He shifts in his seat, rubs a hand against his jeans. Nervous?
You could say that. Although your first name is, in fact, on your name tag at work.
You might not be a good spy, since you just revealed your secret.
Good point. But trust me, I've got more.
I hope so, because that one isn't going to take this conversation very far.
Sean chuckles.
Why don't you tell me a secret? Like, why you don't date?
Or I could maintain my air of mystery, and you could tell me another one of yours. Like where we're going? That would be a good thing to reveal right about now.
He points left, then right, then a sharp left. Over a short wooden bridge that rumbles in a way you remember so clearly, it reverberates in your bones, onto a familiar graveled road. It would have been easier to drive straight off a cliff. You're out of the car faster than the speed of thought, looking up, swallowing hard, arms locked tight against your waist. Except for the distant heave of the ocean, the air's so still. Deep silence everywhere, as if no one's lived here for ages, as though it all fell into an enchanted sleep when your family drove away. There it is, three-tiered like a wedding cake, rose-red brick covered with climbing ivy. Home. I loved this house. You've forgotten Sean until his warmth comes up beside you, the back of his hand brushing yours.
Yeah. He says on a sigh. Me too.
After this, it takes only an inhale to get it.
Sean?
What? Your voice shakes.
What's your last name?
Lowell.
He shoves his fist deep into the pockets of his windbreaker, much too thin to hold off the harsh March wind whipping off the bay. Your throat constricts. You have to suck in air to get the words out.
Look, Sean, Lowell, I don't want to do this, whatever this is.
He steps closer, hands splayed, apology style.
You have every right to be pissed. I was afraid. I knew if I told you the truth, you wouldn't come. I mean, why would you?
Why am I here now? To meet your parents? See how they've redecorated?
He stares at you for a second. Bites his lip, blinks.
A movie and a nice dinner seem sort of inadequate, considering the whole my dad destroyed your family financially thing. Please, Emma, I can do this today. Only today.
Do you get how creepy that sounds? All of this is creepy. You wanted to see me have fun. That's what you said. Instead of, I don't know, mini golf, you've lured me to my old house with God knows what agenda.
Mini golf's really overrated. It's like paintball. Looks so great in the movies, but... Okay, never mind. No luring, I swear. I'm just asking nicely. If you want to leave, I'll drive you back this minute. No matter how things look right now, I swear, I'm a normal person.
You look up at the house. Your old corner room with its high-arched windows. The widow's walk at the top, fenced in with black wrought iron, where you and Jen used to pretend you were captaining a ship, or Pace, waiting endlessly for your mythical boyfriends to come back from sea. That life you barely remember, with no boundaries, no money worries, no limits to anything and everything you could hope for. Sean hunches his shoulders against another quick whip of wind off the water. So you knew who I was all along? An even worse thought occurs to you. Are you doing this for your father? He shakes his head.
No. God, no. At first, I just got that you were this gorgeous girl with great... iced tea. Then I found out your last name and thought... Shit. This sounded so much better in my head. Emma, Dad ripped off a lot of people. But you're the only one whose house we lived in. I wanted to give you... something.
The wind has risen high enough that his words seem to blow away the minute he speaks them. You hear them, though, as clearly as you've seen the headlines. Rupert Lowell, billion-dollar con man. The arrest. The upcoming trial. Sean's father. You mean something more than a $60 tip?
I wanted you to notice me. I didn't know where to start. In retrospect, not there.
Notice you? Have you... seen you?
Christ, Emma.
He's cute is very much beside the point.
Too busy looking at you.
Despite yourself, you crack up. Oh my God, that's the cheesiest line I've ever heard.
But you laughed, he says. So there's that. I haven't even seen you smile at the diner.
I never saw you looking at me.
I'm a spy, remember? Practice at stealth. If not at driving stick or asking a girl on a date.
You search his face, almost squinting to see past his color-changing eyes to what might not be changeable about him. To look beyond the looks. He can probably feel you wavering. Pushes one last time.
No one's here. Please.
So it's just you and me alone in a deserted house? What could possibly go wrong?
It's already gone wrong. I'm aiming to get it right.
Sean ushers you in, holds open the door like he owns the place. Oh, that's right. He does own the place. You look around the kitchen. Shiver. It isn't cold. It's that the house seems like a ghost ship, and you're the ghost in it. With all that money, the splashy lifestyle his parents had, society queen, high-rolling financier, you'd have thought everything would have been redone, possibly dipped in gold or wallpapered in $1,000 bills. But the pale turquoise walls, the piney wooden cabinets, unchanged. Sean shrugs off his windbreaker, passes it to you. You have the sudden sense that if you said your shoes pinched, he'd kick off his own, give them right over.
This way.
He holds out a hand, as though offering the same sort of comfort as the coat, in a different form. You take it, without thinking. If you think, you'll probably leave right now. The staircase is just beyond the kitchen, the banister you used to slide down. You've walked through this house so many times in your head in the past 4 years.
Wait, we're going upstairs? Where the bedrooms are?
Sean's gone one step ahead of you, but he stops and turns back now.
Yeah. I have something to show you. I mean, something you might need and want. Jesus, that's just as bad.
Now you're both laughing,
Too loud in the quiet house. Harder than the moment deserves. Giddy, both of you, with a nervous need to release crazy tension. Then you fall silent. Look at each other in the half-light. It's unknown territory. All of this. Except that it isn't. Except that it's your home. And Sean strangely doesn't seem out of place in it. He holds up a hand, straight-faced now. Just to reassure you, all the furniture's gone. No beds. I feel so much better. Totally at ease now, creepy, luring guy. You know, I really preferred test date. Outside the mullioned window at the top of the stairs, a knife of silver sunlight slashes through the gray clouds, illuminating just enough for you to make out a tall, hunched figure in the corner of the landing. You clap your palm over your mouth, stifling a shriek. Don't worry. Sean steps to the side, giving you a better look. It's just Dad. Good God. It is a huge gold statue of Rupert Lowell. Naked. Except for a fig leaf. Wow. I know. There is not enough money in the world to pay for the therapy my sister and I will need for that one. You look at that gold-plated statue, the forbidding face, eyebrows drawn together, chin lifted, as if challenging the world to deny that Rupert Lowell knows better than most people. The opposite of the boy who stands in front of you, with his open face and his honest eyes. You can't tell everything by looking at a person. But you can tell a lot. You just can. You don't look anything like your father. Well, I dress better. Sean flashes you a smile. Now you're on the second story landing. This part of the house even smells the same. Pine, salt water, musty carpet, as though you've stepped back through time. This house belonged to your grandparents, your grandfather's parents before that. But you left it all behind when you were 13. You never stood in this spot, with a boy watching you, like this. Attention paid. Intent. The corners of Sean's eyes crinkle again as his gaze meets yours. Then he bows his head, kicks his Converse back and forth on the worn carpet. What I want to give you is this. He drops your hand, heading purposefully to the corner room. Yours. No furniture, different wallpaper, a window where there wasn't one, the bookshelf gone. Nothing familiar but the fireplace. No other girl you know grew up with a fireplace in her bedroom, even though it had never worked. Which is why... Down on his knees in front of the fireplace, Sean reaches up the flue. He pulls out the black and white composition book you'd nearly forgotten about, hands it to you. It's sooty, encircled by at least 50 multicolored rubber bands stretching vertically and horizontally. Your way of keeping it safe and private. Although you didn't have prying siblings, and even Jen hadn't known it existed. Sean's watching your face carefully. He has a slash of soot on his forehead, some dusting his hair. The Book of Lost Things, the blue Sharpie writing scrawled across the cover proclaims, by Emma Green. Don't touch. This means you. No exceptions. You hit it. People don't hide things that don't matter to them. I only found it the day we moved out. I thought, well, the title. It seemed like something you'd like to have. Get back. You start to strip off the rubber bands. It's been a few years. The elastics are fragile, dried out. They break easily. I didn't read it, Sean says. Just so you know. You could have simply brought this to me at the diner, you know, without the, you wave your hand, dramatic atmosphere. The bank owns the house now. They change the locks tomorrow. Since I found it when I was going through here one last time, it seemed right that you get to do the same. He rubs the heel of his hand across his forehead. Plus, that was a pretty ferocious warning. No exceptions and all that. For all I knew, there was a curse on the thing. Like the one on King Tut's tomb. You're flicking through the pages now, looking at your messy eighth grade writing. Sean shoves his hands in his pockets, walks over to the window, giving you space for whatever deep, dark secrets or spells he imagines you have in here. I think you're overestimating the powers of a 13-year-old girl, you say. Hey, I've been a 13-year-old guy. Probably not. You didn't read it?
Nope.
You weren't curious?
Hell, of course I was. Damn.
You flip through the pages, settle on one, read aloud, overdoing the ominous voice. Date, January 19th. Place, school cafeteria. Lost. Jake Aruda was next to me in the lunch line. He asked if I could pass the ketchup. I passed it. I didn't say a word. I've been trying to talk to him for 4 months. I could have told him how amazing his time was at the track meet last week. I could have asked him how his little sister was, because I know she had that eye operation. I could have told him I liked ketchup on grilled cheese, too, even though that's actually disgusting. But I choked, and I lost that chance. Resolution. Next time, say something. Anything. You turn a few pages forward. Date. May 2nd. Place. Home. Lost. Mom asked me if I wanted to visit Gran at the hospital. I've been there every single day, and her roommate freaks me out, and it smells weird. But today, when I didn't come, Mom says she cried for almost the whole time Mom was there. Resolution? Next time, don't be selfish. Date. June through August. Lost. Dad signed me up for sailing at the Pettipog Yacht Club. I would literally rather spend the summer in a gulag. Result? The gulag would have been more fun. Resolution? Next time, hunger strike. You flip your hair back from your face. Get the idea?
It's the Book of Lost Opportunities, Sean says.
You nod. I thought it would help me remember to do stuff differently. If I got the chance. He's shaking his head, smiling a little.
What? Did it work?
It turns out Jake Aruda is an asshat. Or was. I haven't seen him since I was 14. Maybe he's made his own resolutions.
He's on my basketball team. And no, once and always, I'm guessing.
You shut the pages of the book. Thank you.
Not as important as I thought it might be, I guess,
Sean says. This is, though, you say, getting to see this place one last time.
Eh, I should have gone with mini-golf.
You set the book down on the floor, walk up to him. His eyes widen, but he doesn't move. See you do. Closer. He smells like soot, soap, salt air, a little bit of sweat. All this was not easy for him. Resolution, you say as he leans just a touch closer, looks down at your lips, then up at your eyes. Do this, you say, and put your lips to his as he wraps his arms tight around your waist. As first kisses go, it probably isn't the best one ever. His forehead bumps into yours. It takes a little while to find the right angle. You breathe in the soot, your eyes water, and you lose a contact lens. You're both nervous, and you hardly know each other, after all. But you will. Before you and Sean leave the house for the last time, you take pictures with your phone, of the view out your bedroom window. The sun comes full out, and the bay sparkles exactly the way you remember. You take one standing on the widow's walk, one from the porch steps where your dad used to sit and read to you while you lay in the grass, half listening and half daydreaming. You take the Book of Lost Things with you, sure, if only to remember you were once idiotic enough to think that a summer of sailing camp was worse than logging time in a gulag. You take with you the sound of the waves slapping against the breakwater, the memory of sitting on the stone wall, stripping the husks off sweet corn and tossing them into the water, hoping to see that green flash that your mom swears happens when the last of the sun sinks down. You take with you the memory of how the house smelled when you woke up in the morning. Coffee. The gasoline pungency in the air as motorboats headed out. Usually combined with the faint,